Well, hello everybody, and thanks for joining us today when we're going to jump into some of the details presented in the President's fiscal year 2015 budget request and its implications for global health programs. As you know, this is intended exclusively for journalists and intended to give you every opportunity to ask questions of our expert presenters, so please do that on the chat feature. I am going to turn this over immediately to my colleagues, Jen Cates and Adam Wexler, and to Tony Fratto, who are sitting in our Washington office. So with that, Jen, take it away.
Thanks so much, Penny. This is Jen Cates. Hi, everyone. I'm here with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and we are going to try to give you some information on what the President's budget request for global health means and provide some broader context for that, and really looking forward to a dialogue with you about this. So we're going to try to present some complex information in a relatively short and simple fashion. And the first section is really just going to focus on the U.S. global health budget in context, give you a sense of what it means to talk about the U.S. global health budget and kind of where the U.S. fits as a donor to global health. So next. So very, very briefly, a few things to know just as background when we think about the U.S. global health budget. This includes all discretionary funding. So for those of you who know about budgets, you understand what this means. But essentially, the part of the budget that every year Congress must appropriate money for. If Congress doesn't appropriate money for these things don't have money. So these are called discretionary. Every year, Congress is asked by the President to appropriate money for a range of health programs, and the ones that we're focused on are those that are in low- and middle-income countries, so really through the U.S. development portfolio. The programs we're talking about include both bilateral and multilateral funding, and by that we mean for bilateral efforts, it's U.S. government efforts that are directed to other countries. Though that could be funding that's provided directly to another country government. More often than not, though, it's funding that's provided by the U.S. to an NGO or an academic institution or some implementer in a country. It could also be technical assistance in those countries, but essentially it's bilateral. It's from the U.S. government to a country. The multilateral piece is when the U.S. provides a general contribution for global health to a multilateral institution, and you're probably all familiar with the biggest one that we know about and talk about in global health, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and that's a multilateral institution for which the U.S. gives a contribution, and the Global Fund in turn gives money to countries. And then in the terms of the programs we're talking about, there's a whole set of program areas that the U.S. Includes in thinking about its global health work. We've listed the main ones here, HIV, and by HIV, think PEPFAR. That's essentially PEPFAR. PEPFAR includes other things as well, but it's PEPFAR. TB, malaria, maternal and child health, nutrition efforts, family planning, efforts to address neglected tropical diseases, and a range of other things. These are the, sort of the big bucket program areas. Next, please. So one thing that we always like to remind people of, we do this with our surveys, we look at what does the public know about foreign aid, what does the public know about global health? And one question, and you might have seen this in our polls and others, the public consistently overestimates the share of the federal budget going to foreign aid. This is what the public says. As you can see in this slide, on average, the public says, yeah, about 28% of our budget goes to foreign aid. In reality, about 1% goes to foreign aid. And this is important because global health, for the most part, is part of this budget. And so it's even less than 1%. And we show this on the next slide. And this is looking at the recent budget request, and it gives you a sense of the overall budget that the President has proposed, about $4 trillion. Global health is a tiny, tiny fraction of that. So what we see is the public is really overestimating how much we're really investing in this area of work. And for those who are interested in this, we do have this survey, and we're happy to talk about some of the other perceptions that we find when we get to the chat and Q&A. Next. So the other thing that often comes up is, okay, so we're going to go into the budget of the U.S., but where does the U.S. fit in the context of other donor governments? You know, really, this is an increasing issue. Is the U.S. doing too much, too little? Who's doing what? And this is an analysis we do every year, and our most recent data show that the U.S. is a little over a third of all donor funding, and that includes donor governments as well as multilateral institutions, all donor government funding for global health in low and middle income countries. Next. And also, we looked at what share of U.S. Development assistance, essentially the money that goes to low and middle income countries for a range of activities, is for global health. And as you can see here, the U.S., relative to other donors, puts a pretty high premium on global health, highest of all of the donors that are the top 10 to global health. So over 23% of the U.S. development assistance is for health. What we're not going to show you today, and we have a whole report on this, though, is, you know, the U.S. has the biggest economy in the world. And so if you standardize this by the size of the U.S. economy, the U.S. is probably, I think, number 7. So it doesn't rise to the top when you do that, but these are just different metrics by which to look at the U.S. role here. So having given you that broad context for where the U.S. fits in the broader global response, as well as what to understand about the budget, Adam Wexler, who's my colleague here at Kaiser, is going to go into the details of the budget request and what we do and don't know. There's some things that we're all going to have to wait to learn. And then we'll turn it over to Tony Fratto, who will give us some thoughts on the budget before we get to your questions. So, Adam?
Great. Thank you very much, Jen. So, as Jen mentioned, I'm going to give an overview of the recent trends in global health funding and also break it down by program areas. This first slide looks at a very unique window of time. As we're all familiar, in 2013, we experienced sequestration, which was the mandatory cuts in across-the-board federal spending because existing funding levels were above the caps set by Congress. So we have that in 2013. And then in 2014, the budget was just passed about 2 months ago. And then now, as of 2 weeks ago, the President introduced the 2015 budget request. So we have a very unique time here where we have sequestration, a recently passed budget, and now a new request. What this slide shows is that total known global health funding, which includes funding from USAID, State Department, and Health and Human Services, is essentially equal to 2013 and slightly below, well, about $400 million below 2014 levels. Next slide. What we thought was a good analysis next was to look at that global health total and compare it to broader budget trends. So what we're looking at here is the global health total compared to the entire international affairs budget, which includes the vast majority of global health funding. We also looked at the broader federal budget, excluding the mandatory programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and also excluding defense. So when you compare global health funding to these other areas, there are some interesting trends. Between 2015 and 2013, global health remained essentially flat, a small increase. At the same time, the international affairs budget increased by 7%, while the non-defense discretionary budget increased by 3%. Now, if you compare 2015 to 2014, global health declined at approximately the same rate as the discretionary budget, but the international affairs budget remained essentially flat. Next slide. Okay, so now let's look at a broader window of time. What this slide shows is global health funding since 2001. And what we can take away from this is that in the previous decade, there were significant increases for global health. These are largely due to the beginning of PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, and also the creation of the Global Fund. But then we had the economic crisis in 2008, and since 2009, funding has remained essentially flat. We had the slight increase recently in 2014, and now we're looking at a decrease in the President's budget request for 2015. Next slide. So what's in that budget request? Now, this slide breaks down the budget request by area. As we can see from this slide, bilateral HIV-AIDS programs account for greater than 50% of that budget request, and is followed by the Global Fund, which accounts for the next largest share, maternal and child health programs, malaria, family planning, TB, nutrition, and neglected tropical diseases in that order. Now, how do these different areas fare compared to their prior fiscal year? Next slide. So this shows the differences between 2014 and 2015. Now, putting the Global Fund aside for a moment, what we can tell from this slide is that all areas declined with the exception of bilateral HIV/AIDS programs, which have remained essentially flat, and malaria and family planning, which experienced slight increases. Now, the Global Fund. Oh, actually, going back, TB was the largest decrease among all the different areas. Now, going to the Global Fund. The President's budget request includes $1.35 billion for the Global Fund. Now, this what's important to remember about this is that it's a $300 million decrease from last year's levels. However, there are a couple of reasons for this. First, by law, the U.S. can only provide a third of total funding to the Global Fund. With this budget request of $1.35 billion, we are near that cap. But the budget request does include the potential for an additional $300 million through a new opportunity, growth, and security initiative. Now, this new initiative would provide $56 billion in funding across a range of different programs split evenly between defense and non-defense spending. But it is above existing funding caps that Congress put in place, and so would require Congress to make changes to those caps and would be funded through closing of tax loopholes and some reforms to mandatory spending. So if that occurs, there could be this $300 million in additional funding for the Global Fund. But again, it would be also be required to have other donors provide increased pledges to the Global Fund. So it's a complicated set of scenarios that would result in the Global Fund reaching prior year levels, but it is a possibility in the budget request. Next slide. Okay, so next, Jen and I are going to highlight a few of the key takeaways from the budget request now that we've covered all the areas and given the background. The first point to make is that compared to 2013, global health funding remained essentially flat, while the international affairs budget and non-defense discretionary spending both increased. Compared to 2014, all program areas declined with the exception of HIV, which remained flat, and malaria and family planning funding, which increased slightly.
And one point, this is Jen, one point on the family planning funding, which I think is an important one to think about. Every year, this becomes sort of a battleground in Congress, and there's a request made by the President, and then in the budget discussions and appropriations back and forth that goes on in the House and the Senate, the House tends to go below the budget request on family planning and reproductive health. The Senate tends to add money back in, and then there's some sort of middle ground that's reached. So this increase that was proposed for family planning reproductive health will be important to watch and see how that plays out, just like the decrease to TB, and see how that plays out, why that decrease happened and what will happen in the congressional discussions about that.
And then the next point is that the 2015 budget request included $45 million in new funding to support a recently announced global health security initiative. Now, this is an initiative that is being conducted through primarily CDC, and that funding would all go to the CDC, and that's entirely new funding. I don't know if you have...
No, I think I'll just go into this next point about the additional funding that could be made available, and Adam talked about this Opportunity, Growth, and Security initiative, and I hope there's some questions about that. It's complicated, but a couple things to think about from the global health budget perspective. One is that it is above the cap, so it's sort of outside the budget right now, and it's not clear that Congress will approve it. But secondly, even if from the budget request perspective, if there was a belief that the Global Fund was already kind of getting to where it could be in terms of the legal requirement that the U.S. can't provide more than a third of its contributions, that $300 million that was held back wasn't put into global health. It was put into this other initiative that may or may not come to fruition, but it wasn't put into another part of the global health budget. So that's why there actually was a decrease in global health funding in the request, one of the big reasons. So just to make that point. And then lastly, it also has been the case, interestingly, in the last 2 years, and I hope we have some discussion about this, and Tony can certainly speak to this, that Congress did approve a higher level of global health funding than the President requested in the budget. So we are almost done. Just to a few things about looking ahead and to think about.
Right. So where are we going moving forward? Well, right now we're in March, and so the House and Senate committees have begun holding hearings to discuss the budgets. And so these are the House and Senate Foreign Affairs and Foreign Relations Committee, as well as the various Appropriations Committees. We're in the thick of that now. April 15th is the next target date. Congress is scheduled to pass the House and Senate budget resolution, which sets the overall discretionary spending limit. But this is unlikely to occur as a result of the spending caps that have already been put in place resulting from the Senator Murray, Representative Ryan agreement that occurred in 2013. From May through September, the appropriations committees will draft and enact the various appropriations bills. And then by October 1st, we will have a new fiscal year with all of the appropriations bills passed. Now, that doesn't always occur, and when Congress does not enact all the appropriations bills, we generally get continuing resolutions, which will fund the federal government for a short period of time and allow Congress some additional time to finalize those appropriations bills.
Yeah, and just to add one other thing, just as an indication of how the dialogue around between the administration and the Congress is going to play out, there was already a hearing in the House on the budget that Secretary Kerry was at last week, and Kay Granger, Representative Granger, who's been a Republican, who's been very supportive of global health, and she's on the Appropriations Committee, asked him about the global health budget and indicated that she felt it was too low and that this was an area of bipartisan support and wanted to know more about why it was reduced. So that just gives you an interesting angle at this, and it also is a great segue for me to turn to Tony Fratto, who's here, and we're really glad he came today. As we indicated, he's a former deputy press secretary to President George Bush, and also was just very involved in global health activities and programs when he was with the administration, including PEPFAR, and there at the beginning when PEPFAR was set up. So I'm going to turn it over to him to maybe give some thoughts about the sort of bipartisan era of global health support. Is it still here, and what might be ahead?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Jen and Adam. That was a terrific review. And first, let me say how much I appreciate Kaiser having me join on this call. It's been I've secretly been stealing a lot of your research and work and passing it off as my own for years. But it's really excellent work, and so it's great. It's such a great resource for all of us who work on these issues. Before the White House, I was at Treasury Department for 5.5 years, and we did a lot of the analytical work and support on the Hill for these programs. And I think a lot of us, within the Bush administration, outside the Bush administration, who worked on the initiation of a lot of these programs, and were able to work across, with leaders on both parties to get support for the programs, worried about what would happen after the administration when we were in a, obviously in a deep financial crisis and recession and tight budget scenario, and a new administration coming in who, although we knew were supportive of these issues, but not necessarily invested in the programs, that they didn't have ownership of the programs, and a lot of new members of Congress who were not there for the start of these programs, and a time when the country is really turning inward in a lot of these things. So we look at those, there was one of the slides that showed the increase in budget for global health issues, which I think I recall it looks like it the funding doubled every 3 years, roughly. From 2001 to 2010. And although we could look at that, what happened from 2010 on, as essentially flat, and I guess one way we could look at that is say that, it took a lot of work to keep it even flat, and to keep support for it, if you, in the environment that we were in. But that's flat in nominal dollars. It's not flat in real dollars. In real dollars, that these actually are reductions, modest reductions. Just have to keep that in mind also. But those are substantial increases for really successful programs. And to the point that Kay Granger made also about the bipartisan support for these programs, it has proven to be durable for global health. Not necessarily the same for some of the other development programs, but for global health, it has proven to be durable bipartisan support, and I think we just need to continue to build on that. And I think a lot of us are just trying to do everything we can to demonstrate the success of the programs and how important they are to the country, to our country, and to the countries in which they're being executed. So, I want to save a lot of time for questions. If we can, I think we're going to open it up to questions next, and there's a whole lot of things that we can talk about. But I think that we have some work to do. Adam talked about the budget process a little bit. If you haven't been in Washington in a few years, like even having something like a budget process seems like a brand new thing. We don't talk about it as a regular thing because it hasn't been regular. We haven't had any kind of real regular order for a number of years. So it is actually good to see that there are going to be hearings. There will be really an opportunity to go up and sit in a hearing room and present evidence for the success of these programs and hopefully maintain the support that we've had.
I'm going to suggest at this point that anyone on the call who has questions, please start sending them in on the chat function. And are you ready to go with questions at this point? I'm going to call the first one from Tom Paulson in Seattle. Obama's request cuts global health while proposing increases in other areas of foreign assistance. Is this evidence that the Obama administration thinks health has been overemphasized as a development tool as compared to other categories like education, energy, and so on? Over to you.
Well, I think this is Tony. I think Jen and Adam can explain some of that cut, and some of it is it has to do with the new program and the model for funding for the global fund that has a big impact in the health budget. I think there are I give a lot of credit to the administration for looking at creative ways in this tight fiscal environment that we've been in to still look for some creative ways to work on development, either from some of the things we're doing on Food for the Future and Power Africa, I think are fairly innovative, even if not substantial amounts of new money, but they are innovative and I think pointed in the right direction. The health program, so I know that they have views on the evolution of some of the health programs, especially PEPFAR, and Jen, you're really the expert on that. But I think they still see it as a really valuable tool for development, but they have views on the evolution of the programs.
Yeah, this is Jen, Case. I say there's a tension there because I think PEPFAR funding for HIV bilateral programs is at a low compared to where as lowest level compared to 2009 at this point. And part of that is, the rise that we saw before is unlikely to continue at that rate. It was a pretty, substantial increase due to unique circumstances and an emergency response prior to an economic downturn. But also a shift in how the administration is thinking about PEPFAR and its role in the future and how it works with other countries. There are planned reductions in spending in some countries, South Africa, for example, and others. So there are planned reductions. And the tension is that there are still a lot of unmet needs. There's still big targets and concern on one end that how are those going to be met and reached? And there's so much unmet need as we're maybe scaling back in some places, and it's unclear how much scaling back there will be. But these are issues that are really difficult to take on. So, Tom, to just answer your question, I don't think it's necessarily evidence that the administration doesn't think global health is important. I think the administration has shown that they do think global health is important. I think Congress has also shown that. But I think the how it fares in this larger context and where you put resources and what's seen as most effective is still causing tension and difficult discussions.
This is Adam Wexler. One thing I would add is that global health is still one of the largest shares of the overall international affairs budget, and that should be an indicator, has been for some time, and it's continuing this year. Even though the slight decrease, it's still a very significant share of that overall budget.
Tony, you commented on the importance of global health to the U.S. and to the countries affected, and there's a question which in a sense leaps off from that, from Alan Gaisel in Philly. Is there a breakdown of where this funding goes by regional country? And I think we might need to address that both in terms of currently under the current budget and looking forward as we think about the budget proposed for 2015.
Yeah, hi, this is Jen Cates. For the proposed budget, the full breakdowns aren't completely available yet. We have some of that. But we do track this at Kaiser. We do have the global health budget overall broken down by region, by country, and just the sort of top line is Africa is the in terms of the area of the world that's getting the most resources. And countries, we have a top 10, and we also have it by different programs. So generally, countries in sub-Saharan Africa are getting the most money in large part because of their HIV epidemics and PEPFAR being the largest part of the budget. But we can provide the where we have the current information, I believe, is fiscal year 13 for the final detail that's been made available, and we're happy to get that out to folks. It'll be a resource link off of this presentation as well.
Tony, do you want to just pick up, though, on the sort of perhaps broader, even more philosophical point about what is the importance to the country, to the U.S., and perhaps also to the countries affected? How important is the global budget to this country, and why is this why is it still a bipartisan topic?
It's a great question, and I think it underpins a lot of where we get support for these programs, and it's for different reasons. Some people see it as a security issue. Coming out of 9/11, that it was this is a way to prevent failed states and where there were sources for terrorism. I'm not a believer in that view. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that, but that is one area where some members see it as a reason to support it. There's a large number of members on both sides of the aisle who see it really as a moral issue, and I think President Bush saw it as a moral issue more than anything else. If people are dying, and it's one of the biggest obstacles to development, also, and we have the means to do it and do it effectively, then we have an obligation to do it. And I think a lot of members felt that way, still do, and I know President Bush felt that way as well, and I know I've heard President Obama speak to it in the same way. There's a lot of evidence. In fact, there's some recent evidence too that just from a diplomacy standpoint, if we're trying to improve the image of the United States, you look at countries that are recipients of U.S. Development assistance, and in particular from the global health programs. And almost nowhere in the world is the United States more popular than in those countries. It's pretty significant. There was just another recent study
just came out from some researchers at Dartmouth.
At Dartmouth,
that looked at this, and they found this very strong correlation that supported some earlier studies that looked at this. So essentially where there was large amounts of U.S. assistance for health, there was much more supportive and friendly views towards the U.S. government.
Yeah.
It's hard to know the direction of all those, but it's really it's interesting evidence that people are looking at and trying to understand.
Yeah, so we see, so there's value in it, but I'm going to say there's one other thing that the programs have done very, very well, and that is counter to the views of a lot of critics of overseas development assistance is that one of the general criticisms of overseas development assistance is that you can't see evidence of success, and there's this general view that the money's being wasted. It's lost on corruption. It's lost on administration expenses, by you know, depending on who's administering the funding. And what all of these programs have done very, very well is show success down to, you know, being able to count the number of people being serviced, the number of lives being saved, the number of being able to show the reductions in the incidence of mother-to-child transmission, of HIV, all of these kinds of things are really rigorous numbers and metrics for success have been really, really helpful. And it's harder to do with, it's harder to show those same kind of metrics with some of the other development programs also.
So really sort of moving on from here, Marissa Miley at Global Post is asking, how did the trends towards country ownership and work with the private sector play into this budget request? We haven't really touched on that here because we've been focusing on the U.S. government commitment, but could you talk about country ownership and the role and input from the private sector?
Yeah, this is Jen Cates. This is a really critical piece to think about and its implications in the budget request. So country ownership, which is a broad concept that means different things to different audiences, but essentially the way the U.S. government is using that concept is to as a way to work differently with traditionally recipient countries, those countries that the U.S. has been providing health assistance to. How can it work with those countries in a different way so that the countries themselves become owners, have more ownership in the design of the global health programs that they have in their countries, in carrying out those programs and implementing them, and ultimately in financing them. That's sort of an ultimate goal, and by country ownership, the U.S. has said it means the recipient country governments as well as civil society. So it's about changing the sort of traditional donor and recipient relationship, as well as shifting over time to less direct support from the U.S. going to other countries and having their budget support more over time. That's the sort of general concept. In reality, that is a lot harder to do. There have been several studies that have come out talking about this. We've done some analysis in this area, and the idea that most of the countries that we are providing assistance to will be able to finance in any significant way the global health response in their countries, it's going to be a very, very long time before that it occurs in a significant way. Now, there are some exceptions to that. I mentioned South Africa earlier, and this is what I was alluding to. The U.S. and South Africa are probably the furthest along in terms of this discussion around PEPFAR, and there's a planned reduction because of country ownership and because of South Africa being in a position to be able to take on more of the funding of its own HIV response, and you can see that in the budget over time. So that is part of what's happening in to some extent in this budget. But I think the flip side is that many studies are starting to show that the idea that most of the countries that are getting funding from the U.S. government will be able to provide significant shares of their own domestic resources to global health, that's going to be a very long time and down the road. So, to the extent we see a little bit of that happening in this budget, yes, but I think it's going to play out over many, many years. I don't know if you want to add anything, Tony or Adam.
I think that's all right.
Maybe you could also touch on the private sector, and I suppose that would include major philanthropies and religious-based groups that obviously play a role here, too.
Yeah, I mean, the private sector is really critical and has been identified by the U.S. government and others as critical to global health response in a couple of ways. And just lumping the private sector together for a second as the private sector, it's both in terms of the funding that that sector can provide, which most think will never, it's never going to be at the same level as donor governments, but it's significant in some cases, and the type of expertise and comparative advantage that the private sector often brings to delivery of services, to innovation, to partnering. And so the private sector has become and actually has been a pretty important partner for PEPFAR since its beginning, but is really becoming an increasing partner of USG global health and development programs for those reasons, both to co-invest, but also really for a different approach, sometimes faster approach, sometimes able to do things, in the case of foundations, that the government can't do. So that is really, I say, you know, going forward, the private sector is going to be looked to for more and more. Not sure the private sector will ever make up a huge financial response like a government. But I think it's, you know, increasingly, I'll let Tony fill in, but very, very clearly an important sector.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, just from a funding standpoint, they'll never mean that. But I'm really excited by what I'm seeing from a lot of really creative thinking on the private sector. And it's everything from, you know, companies like GE Foundation is trying to be really innovative in the way they're thinking about how to do more. And then a lot of technology firms looking at ways to apply their knowledge on data and systems and how that can be helpful to making the delivery of health services much more efficient and targeted and thinking about prevention and it's happening in a lot of different ways. In Africa, where I'm most familiar with, where there's such a huge opportunity for productivity gains in the delivery of healthcare, and some of that is just building on the backbone of things that have already been put in place by bilateral, multilateral donors. Things like, you know, some of the backbone that has been created by PEPFAR and the Global Fund, for example. What's the best way to maximize the use of that backbone? What's the best way to improve both the quantity and quality of health servicers, of nurses and doctors? And so there's so many different ways that the private sector can sort of plug in and to have a really big impact, and not as a replacement, but really additive to what the official sector is doing and creating.
Yeah, one thing to add, this is Jen again. The Global Fund has been really key in this, in mobilizing the private sector, both for direct contributions to the Global Fund, as well as playing a role, innovative role, partnering with the fund and partnering in country to do exactly what Tony was talking about. So, very important point raised by the question.
Jen and actually Tony, you talked a little bit about the American public, and of course, Jen, you focused on the general overestimate of people's guess about what part of the budget does go on global health, let alone on foreign aid. Can you talk about, you know, when people really focus on it, when they hear about the budget in any detail, what's the sense then about support for global health?
I'm both a personal and professional advocate, I think, for these programs. So I feel like I'm out talking about them a lot, and it goes back to my days in the administration. And since then, whether it's some of the things that like Gates has tried to do with the Living Proof program that they've done, and others, is that, you know, breaking down the myths of foreign assistance and global health in particular is just the first step. So helping people understand just what the size of our commitment is, just exactly how much money is being spent and what a small share it is of overall spending is, is just the first step to try to get support. You then have to answer that second question, which I just touched on a little bit, which is our financing being put to good use? Right? Is it effective, and is it doing good? And we always felt that when we were out fighting for these programs, that if we could show real outputs, you know, real success measuring outputs, not just measuring inputs, but really measuring outputs and showing success, that, and you present that to the American people or to represent it to their representatives in Congress, that they will be generous if you can arm them with really, really good evidence. And so we tried to just do the best job we could with pictures and video and really rigorous data showing that the programs were successful. And so to me, like, that's what needs to be done more than anything. I try to do it in the small ways that I can, but just really, really good data out there showing that it's being effective. You're still going to have some people who don't think we should be involved overseas. You're going to have some people who don't want to be convinced that it's effective and important to the country. But there are a lot of people who want to be persuaded, and their only objection is that they would support it if they knew that it was being that these were good, solid programs and effective programs. And so we need to show them that.
Yeah, just to add, thanks so much, Tony. From our survey work with the American public, what we find generally is that when we start to ask people more specific questions, like, you know, do you support HIV programs or programs for maternal and child health, the more specific you can be, the more support there seems to be. I should also point out that when we ask people, and they say that they have the support for moral reasons, and they think it's the right thing to do, that the U.S. should be doing this. Of course, when you ask people, do you still have the same level of support if it means, you know, you're having tough times at home and we have to choose between our budget at home and budget overseas, people get a little less supportive. But in general, what we find is, you know, a growing trend towards globalization. Younger people see this. Younger people have support. So it is, you know, it's a changing environment in that regard.
So Tom Paulson, always a good critique expected from Tom in Seattle, is really asking here, how is the budget request not evidence of the current administration's relative lack of interest in global health if you think that most of the major push funding thinking came before the current Obama administration? And he sort of points out that many in the global health community feel that the current administration doesn't seem to have a coherent global health policy. If you look at the rise and fall of interest and other issues, so how would you respond to that?
Look, sometimes I feel like when I'm critical of the Obama administration, it sounds very self-serving, because we all feel like parents of these programs, and so we're very protective of them and would love to see them grow and expand. Don't get me wrong, Tom. You know, I would love to see, you know, much more aggressive work on developing some of the programs, and certainly on funding levels. Would love to see, you know, much higher funding levels than what we've ended up with. But I am also cognizant of the fact that we've been in a really tough environment. And, you know, if you have to go to Congress and ask for funding for these programs, and if you go back 7-8 years ago and say, who were the champions of these programs in Congress? Almost all of them are gone. Almost every single one of them. And I don't think it's a correlation. I don't think they're gone because they supported these programs, but they're not there anymore. And so we've had to try to build more support on the Hill for these programs. Lindsey Graham in the Senate, when we talk about looking for, you know, real strong support for these programs, we're generally looking on the Republican side, because that's where most of the critics are. Lindsey Graham has been really strong on support of these programs and has been an advocate with other members. He's taken members to on trips to see the evidence of these programs, and he's being primaried, you know, because he's seen as sort of, you know, a soft member of Congress. So, you know, that's the lesson that a lot of members get. So I would really like to see the administration be a lot stronger and push a lot more for these programs. I think there's so much more that can be done. And when I see the level of spending that we've seen over the past 5 years, and I see it leveled off, I can't help but look at it and say, you know, if we had continued the trend of increases, how many more lives would be saved, right? If you can count it that way. If the trend line has continued and you look at the delta over what, you know, funding could have been versus what it is, I see lives that aren't saved. And so, you know, that's what I would really, really prefer to see. But it is a tough political environment to get more action. To get more support here in for these programs.
Well, and with due respect to all the terrific reporters on this webinar, one could also say, you know, where are the active journalists covering global health who were actively engaged X years ago too? I'm afraid that that's another whole set of challenges which we won't get into now. Before we wrap up, I was just going to ask you to go back to the Global Health Security Initiative that you mentioned, which is proposed new funding. Could you just give a bit more information on that, and then we're going to wrap this up?
Yes, so this is a new initiative announced about a month and a half ago that is focused on providing funding to detect, prevent, and address emerging threats. And so CDC is taking the lead on this. They have a number of programs abroad already in place to address these kind of emerging issues that could be a threat to populations worldwide. And this new initiative is in partnership with a number of other countries to increase that capability. And that $45 million in new funding would be through the CDC, and would be focused on building up that capability and addressing these emerging threat issues. Whether or not that amount proceeds through Congress remains to be seen. This is a part of the debate that will continue. But it is an area that the Congress has pointed out as a priority through this announcement and through this announcement of $45 million in new funding.
Well, thank you. And with that, we're going to wrap up this webinar. All the slides that were presented will be available on the Kaiser website fairly shortly. We'll have a transcript. And we do, of course, have a number of other global health-related events. And at any time, if we can help, we've got expertise in-house, as you can tell. I'm just going to put in a plug for it's World TB Day on Monday, March the 24th, and we'll be having an event with Frontline on Tuesday the 25th to focus on the particular challenges with TB, which, as was mentioned, has looks like it's having the budget will be cut for TB, which would be an interesting set of questions to address too. Thank you to Tony Fredo for joining us today, and again, thank you to all of you, and please get in touch if you can think of other topics that might be good for us to address through a webinar, if not in person. Thank you again. I'm going to wrap this up.